tuned in to the Community Cats Podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Welcome to the Community Cats Podcast. I'm your host, Stacey LeBaron. I've been involved helping homeless cats for over 20 years with the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society. The goal of this podcast is to expose you to amazing people who are improving the lives of cats. I hope these interviews will help you learn how you can turn your passion for cats into action. And today we're speaking with Dot Baisley. Dot has volunteered for IAABC for many years. She started as the shelter division chair, then was elected to the board of directors, and finally was the vice president of the board before becoming the executive director. Think you've done all things for this organization, Dot? Dot is a certified professional dog trainer, certified dog behavior consultant, certified cat behavior consultant, and certified shelter behavior specialist. She holds a master's degree in animal behavior from Tufts University. She's been working in animal behavior for over 20 years, both in animal welfare and rescue organizations in New York and New England, and with private clients as a consultant evaluating dogs and educating staff and volunteers. Before joining the staff at IAABC, she was the director of behavior for Northeast Animal Shelter in Massachusetts. Dot also volunteers for the Shelter Playgroup Alliance and spends her free time playing with her two dogs, Angus and Porkchop. Dot, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So we've had some great conversations over the years, and it's been a while since we've chatted. So I'm very excited about our conversation today. But first and foremost, how'd you get to be so passionate about cats?
Well, I think that's an origin story, right? I've always had cats. I grew up in a household with cats. One of the first pictures ever taken of me as a newborn was on my grandmother's bed with her five cats. I remember the first cat that was in my life was there before I arrived, and I think we had him until I was about 7 or 8, but his name was Homer, and my grandmother found him under the front steps in the middle of the winter, and he lost the tips of his ears to frostbite. And so he was my boy, adored that cat, and he was bigger than me first of my life. And then when I was about 5, my grandmother, I went to a barn and adopted 2 4-week-old kittens because their mother had been hit by a car, and they fit in the palm of my hand. And they were 2 little torties named Mike and Ike. And I had one of them for about 10 years and the other one for 16 years. I loved torties because of them. It just started being my grandmother's granddaughter, I think, really. The rescue part and the cat part and the dog part, too. We ended up rescuing dogs, and she went to the shelter in Brewster and adopted a dog that didn't have function in one of its eyes. And she was like, I have to adopt that one because nobody else is going to. And then later on, I went to Brewster and adopted my first dog, who was a behavioral nightmare and turned me into a behavior person. And then I ended up working for that shelter many years later and working with the person who adopted that dog to me at the age of 16.
Wow. Comes around full circle. Some of the folks that are listening to this podcast are people that are out there just, they're feeding community cats. They're trying to figure out how to trap community cats. And here I am, I'm interviewing you, very behavior oriented. What does it mean to be a certified cat behavior consultant? What is that?
The International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants, who I work for, is a membership and certifying body, right? So we are one of the very few third-party credentials available to behavior professionals. What I mean by third-party is that we do not provide the education. We come in and you show up. We assess the skills and knowledge that you have about that particular subject. So we have that available for shelter dog, shelter cat, owned cats, owned dogs, parrot and equine, and also dog trainer and shelter affiliate. The certification itself is fairly rigorous, internationally recognized certification. Demonstrate your knowledge of behavior, your ability to work with clients, your ability to work with the veterinary professionals and to build a community that cares for the animal, but is ethically focused and science-based. So it's humane training that is least intrusive, minimally aversive, and ensures maximizing welfare and maximizing the human-animal bond.
So feline behavior training has changed a lot, or the way we approach feline behavior has changed a lot over the years.
Yes.
Yeah, I started back in 1994, and I will tell you, I have scruffed cats before, back in the day. I'm sorry. You know, and if somebody told me back in 1994 that I would be talking about food puzzles, I would go, what? Are you crazy? What the heck is that? Right?
Right.
And so lots of things. The toolbox has changed. The approach has changed. What have been the biggest changes that you have seen over the years with regards to working with cats?
The biggest change is that people who own cats now are actually seeking behavior advice. It's an emerging market, really. It's the understanding of the animal's welfare and maximizing that welfare through ethical and humane behavior change. It's no longer scruffing. It's no longer using forced socialization. It's how I used to socialize kittens. You pick them up, you carry them around, you squish them until they accept it. That has changed dramatically in my time in animal welfare, is how we socialize kittens that are under-socialized or come from freeborn or free-roaming situations. In like handling scruffing, you don't scruff to, it's not safe. We realize now that it is not an appropriate way to manage and handle a cat, and that a towel is your best friend. So for medical handling, for movement, or for any type of care and shelter, particularly, you don't have to pick up and scruff that cat. You can do 1,000 other things that remove fear, minimize stress, and minimize anxiety.
Do you think our general public is very aware of feline behavior or enrichment? Do you think that it, you know, take yourself out of that animal welfare space, talking to the general public, are they even aware that there's vertical scratching, there's horizontal scratching, there are different, there's covered litter boxes, there's uncovered. How do you think that the general public is graded on that scale?
I think it's becoming more and more prevalent, but there's a lot of room to grow. 90% of my own cat cases come to me through a referral from their veterinarian. Because most folks think that their veterinarian is the behavior expert for cats as well, the full resource for cats. And fortunately, I think the veterinary world is coming to realize that behavior is so very complicated, and therefore they do need to spend a little bit more time educating themselves and also partnering and working with qualified professionals who are focused on that area of expertise. And it can be complicated. I see behavior cases quite often where I then say, right back at the veterinarian. I had a really interesting case last year when I was working through Heal Veterinary Clinic in Watertown, who still refers cats to me, even though I'm across the country now, and that it was a cat who was vocalizing at odd times and had a very ritualized behavior. Digging into the animal's background, turns out that she probably had IBD, but they hadn't fully diagnosed it yet. And so then it was a situation of, I feel that this behavior is pain related, so I'm going to give that right up to the veterinarian. So it's much more of a deep dive into where those lines cross and how they influence each other. I think really the future of animal behavior consulting is that partnering and integration of care, incorporated care through the veterinarians and the consultants working together.
So veterinarians are overwhelmed, they're overworked, they're overstressed. There's a veterinary shortage all across the country. Do you think, I would think this would be a helpful situation, then they're able to refer out for support,
right?
So that you can take the time and do the necessary assessments that are needed, that number one, the veterinary practice doesn't even have the skill set for.
Right.
But then they also just don't even have the time to deal with it. So they're trying to offload more to like specialists, I guess I would say.
Right. And that to me is the hope for the future, is that recognizing this as that specialty. You would refer an animal with cancer to an oncologist, refer an animal with a behavior problem to a behavior consultant or a veterinary behaviorist, right? But veterinarians tend to think veterinary behaviorist, but there's only 40 in the country. It's about 40. I think they just passed like four more. I just saw an announcement. So there's 44 or 45, somewhere in that ballpark. So there's not enough VBs, veterinary behaviorists, in this world to support the needs of all of the animals that we have in our care that are at a higher level of behavior concern or complication.
With the clients that you see that have cats, what are the most common reasons they come to you?
Most common intercat aggression is probably one I see quite frequently. I tend to specialize in dogs and cats in human-directed aggression. I had a client not that long ago whose cat would redirect on her whenever a delivery person arrived at the front door. And the most recent cat that I saw was a cat that had been living in the home for 10 years, and she was getting older and couldn't tolerate any longer the bites and scratches from the petting-induced overstimulation, arousal, aggression, whatever labels you want to use on that. You pet me for too long, and then I get overstimulated, and I bite your hands. The biggest complication was that she wanted to continue sleeping with the cat, but when she moved at night, the cat would swat at her for moving. So we had to come up with some pretty creative ways of maintaining the bond and maintaining the relationship, but also maintaining safety.
Our friends in the Great White North want to hear from you. Humane Canada, the Federation of Humane Societies and SPCAs, and the convener of Animal Welfare in Canada is looking for presentation proposals for its annual signature conference, the Summit for Animals. This conference unites the animal welfare sector once a year in a different Canadian city. In 2025, it'll be held in beautiful Montreal from April 27th to 29th, and they have just opened their call for speakers. If you have insights, knowledge, or experience in animal welfare, consider submitting a presentation proposal by September 30th. Educational topics for next year include marketing, shelter and community medicine, farmed and wild animal welfare, community-based sheltering, fund development, and more. Visit humanecanada.ca/summit to learn more and submit your proposal. Are you getting your message across to your entire community? Do they know what programs you offer and what they can do to help? Learn more about how to effectively market your organization or just sharpen your skills with a free self-paced marketing course, The Fundamentals of Marketing on Maddie's University. The course is designed to provide a basic understanding of marketing and provide you with templates and tools to elevate and improve your organization's brand, voice, and audience, and have fun while doing it. You'll receive a strategic marketing plan template to download free. Go to university.maddiesfund.org and search marketing to enroll now. Are you a proud cat parent looking for the perfect, affordable health care for your kitty? Well, look no further than the Community Cat Clinic, conveniently located in Woodstock, Georgia, just north of Atlanta and not too far from the Tennessee and South Carolina borders. The health and happiness of all cats are the top priorities at this feline-only hospital. From preventative care, spay, neuter, and vaccines, to specialized and innovative treatments like full mouth dental, ultrasound, radio, iodine therapy, emergency blockage cases, they got your cat's well-being covered. For the TNR community and local shelters, they offer easy-to-access, low-cost spay-neuter services and volume appointments. So if you want to do a large TNR project, this is the clinic you want to go to. It's worth the extra trip. Appointments are available most days. Check out the Community Cat Clinic online at communitycatclinic.com or visit them in person at the Walmart Shopping Center at the Shops of Trickham on Highway 92 at Trickham Road in Woodstock, Georgia. More purr, less price. When you were working in the shelter environment, you were involved with the establishment of a TNR program. And I'm just curious what your experience was and where does feline behavior come into play in determining like which cat comes in to be put up for adoption versus which cat gets neutered or tipped and returned? Is there a feline behavior role in that scenario?
There absolutely is. And I think the understanding of feline socialization history to humans being a spectrum is very key in that process. So traditionally, we use the word feral to indicate that the animal was freeborn or free roaming, but the myriad of different options and scenarios. So what influences socialization to humans? It's genetic, it's learning history, it's all of these things. You never take a cat off the street and know right away what their history with people is. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you pick them up and they just start chirping and you're like, okay, cool. But what's the difference? How do you tease out the difference between fearful and shut down in a lack of socialization history with humans? And where do they fall within that spectrum of socialization to humans? And what is going to be more humane and more stressful to that individual? Is it taking them out of the environment that they've been successful in up to this point and putting them into a kennel and keeping them in an environment that is highly stressful to them for an undetermined amount of time to then place them into another environment that they're unfamiliar with? Or alternative placement? Do they go into a barn? Do they go into a working cat program, a spirit cat program, any of those types of programs? And depending on where you are, there's legality around that. In different parts of the country, it is illegal to put cats out into barns. In the state of Massachusetts, it's illegal to relocate because that's considered abandonment if you put them where you didn't get them from. It's extremely complicated, quite often also very emotionally motivated in the shelter environment because you get disagreement from people. No, that cat's just shut down. How do you determine that the cat is shut down versus not having that socialization history, and that those can be very subtle signs? Cats that have a socialization history to humans but are shut down do tend to have some level of communication with humans, even if it's eating in the presence of a human or not trashing their kennel overnight or blinking or averting their gaze or lip licking. These are all behaviors of cats that tend to be more on the shutdown spectrum than the totally or unlikely to have had a socialization history with humans. And those are the cats where you get those direct stares and the lack of movement and all of these other behavioral indicators that they don't communicate with people. And therefore, what is the most humane outcome for an animal that doesn't have a socialization history to people? Is unlikely to rehabilitate, because cats have what we refer to as a flexible social structure, but that means you have to influence that social structure before 8 weeks of age.
And genetics, the family line, makes a huge difference. I can get a 5-week-old kitten in that's fourth generation feral or whatever, and that's going to be a hard kitten to socialize, even if you get it that young. And then you could get a 4-month-old that's from a buttercup mother cat that just happened to be abandoned, but she was still teaching her kittens the socialization skills there. And that's a much easier fluff and fold, I would call those.
Exactly. And that has a lot to do with not only the history from mom in the generation of my term that I made up, which is ferility. I like to make up words sometimes. Versus there's also research out there that indicates that the father, the male cat, which you're never going to know who dad is, the plasticity within that socialization is somewhat determined by dad as well. And so there's some research out there indicating that is the truth. Granted, this was done in laboratory cats about 10, 15 years ago. How valid is that? Who's going to repeat that experiment? It doesn't really matter because we're never going to know who dad was. But those are influences that we have zero control over, zero knowledge over, and we get these kittens in front of us, and people ask you or me as the behavior professional, okay, we got that 4-month-old last week, and it socialized really quickly and really easily and very well, and you're saying this one's unlikely to do the same, but they're, in that person's mind, very similar cases when they're probably not because of all of those factors that we don't have any knowledge of.
You've been in animal welfare in a variety of different roles. So I'm going to ask you a loaded question, which is, we have a lot of challenges going on, I think, right now in animal welfare. We seem to be sliding backwards, potentially, in at least the tide of the number of cats and dogs that we're seeing in our shelters. There's a lot of challenges, a lot of stress, a lot of human resource challenges, too, I would say, with staffing, recruiting staff, burnout, just the clarity of the job and all that stuff. If Dot had a magic wand and could fix all of this, what would you do?
I think if I had a magic wand, the answer would be the same for the behavior profession and for sheltering, which is setting those industries up to be standardized, a little bit more oversight and regulation there, with the understanding that only comes through good education. the ability to be standardized, the ability to meet regulation, you have to be well educated. I'm starting to see more and more of it, but it is a huge gap in behavior because it's an unregulated field. So I can go down the street and learn from Joe Schmo how to fix cat behavior. And that may include squirt bottles, scat mats, and all of these other devices that I would never consider using in my own practice because they are positive punishers, which means adding an aversive, not a positive. And that is a mathematical term, not an emotional term. Use of those tools and techniques for intervention that are quite outdated. So I would love to be able to, you know, wave that magic wand and say, everybody gets this quality education in husbandry and disinfection and cleanliness and in behavior and in human communication and all of these other things, because working in an animal shelter takes a lot more than being able to pick up a leash or a carrier and move that animal from one place to another. And the biggest issue in animal welfare, as I see it, is that the most difficult, physically demanding, emotionally demanding, and knowledge-based skills fall on entry-level positions. So we bring in all of these well-meaning kids, because they're usually like in their late teens and early 20s, and ask them to learn how to handle aggressive animals, how to deal with the public, how to deal with the public in highly emotional situations, surrender, law enforcement, adoption, returning of adoption, all of these situations. Adoptions can be extremely emotional. It really can. And we don't educate them on how to teach adults, how to help adults learn how to live not just with an animal, but that animal in particular. And now we have too many animals in our shelters, so we can't get to know that individual to then set them up to succeed in that home. So education, magic wand education, make it quality education that is accessible to everybody, that you start with the knowledge base and build from there.
And I would assume that would apply also to foster home-based organizations too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think maybe even more so, you know what I'm saying? Because your communication to humans is virtual. It's usually not in person. It's via email or text message or Slack or one of those other messaging apps. My experience in foster-based, and having been on the board of directors for a foster-based rescue for a few years, the communication was really challenging. The human communication, and also making sure that the animals were kept safe and the community was safe with those animals in the community. A lot of risk factors there.
Yeah, but I would say that during the pandemic, though, a lot of the rescues were really at an advantage on the adoption side of things, because as long as they could turn their Zoom on, then the playing field became more level because the shelters moved all their animals out into foster care, but the rescues were already set up that way. And so a lot of those rescues ended up adopting out more animals than they normally would during the pandemic, which was good to get their population down. And again, there have been a variety of changes and challenges from the standpoint of post-pandemic pets and the challenges with that. Cats like their routine, and routine was changed dramatically one way to the other and all that kind of stuff. But I do think that the Zoom interview is very beneficial for cats, maybe even more so than dogs, because you get to see that cat in an environment where they feel comfortable. They don't feel intimidated because it's a new scent, it's a new smell, it's a new person. You can see them being who they can be. And then you work so the family can get that cat feeling that way with them.
Yes. And for cats in particular, the difference in behavior, I don't want to say personality, but their actual behavioral output is so environmentally influenced that cats in a home setting, and the adopter then gets to picture that cat in their home, right?
Right.
It's hard to picture that cat in a cage in your home, but if they're in somebody else's home sitting on their couch, then you just put your own couch in and you're good to go. But yeah, so it really does showcase who the cat is as an individual in that way and what their behavior is more likely to be like in the next home.
So Dot, I'm going to ask you another question about getting certified.
Yes.
Do you have to be like a graduate from college to do this? Or if somebody said, hey, I want to get on track for this, how do they do that?
So that is a large part of why we have the membership base. You can join the National Association of Animal Behavior Consultants. It doesn't matter what your experience level is at all. You join the community of other behavior professionals and you start your learning journey. And so you have that ability to reach out to other professionals and say, where can I get this education? Where should I go to get this? Oh, I was looking at this. What has been your experience? I'm working with this cat or dog and I'm experiencing this challenge. How would you address it? So that is the community part where we build knowledge and help people support each other in that building of knowledge. And then once you have enough experience and that's practical hands-on experience, the level of book learning that you need does not need to be an actual degree. You can get that learning through going to conferences. One of my favorite people to learn about cat behavior from is Tabitha Cusera. You can learn a lot from somebody like herself and then apply that to your certification. So there is, to answer the question, there is no educational requirement at this point to become certified. But it is the skills and knowledge necessary. Some of that you have to get through education.
If folks are interested in finding out more about your organization, how would they do that?
IAABC.org.
Very easy. Excellent.
They can email me at director@IAABC.org or my membership director at membership@IAABC.org.
Dot, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners today?
I want to stress the importance of shelter behavior programming, particularly when it comes to cats. I think it's an overlooked space in a lot of organizations, and it is something that is important. It is something that I am passionate about, something I love working with shelters to set up behavior programs. I do a lot of consulting with shelters around how to house your cats and better ways to reduce stress and how to provide in-kennel enrichment and how to work with cats that might be challenging to place and stuff like that. But I want to encourage people in the sheltering industry to look for hiring certified behavior professionals to work in their shelters with their animals, especially their cats, and to focus on the full care of the animal, which includes their mental health as well.
Wonderful. Dot, I want to thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest on our show, and I hope we'll have you on again in the future.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.